Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on this morning's magazine, as it is Veterans Day, we'll hear about veterans suffering from PTSD who are at a high risk for suicide. The trailer for a new documentary about a young Colorado veteran who died by suicide on Veterans Day in 2015 will be screened in Denver this evening. We'll speak to Ethan's mother about his legacy and her fight to raise awareness about the startling statistics around veteran suicide. 22 veterans a day are estimated to die by suicide. Then, with Thanksgiving less than 3 weeks away and Christmas decorations already in stores, we are, it seems, in the holiday season, but this can be a difficult time for many people. We'll hear from Kim Mooney, who has worked in end-of-life education and bereavement support for many years, on how to survive this season if you're feeling loss. After headlines from the BBC, we'll get a new commentary from Jim Hightower. Then on A Public Affair this morning, we'll have a special guest joining us live. Best-selling author Richard Louv has become well known for writing about the need for children to get out in nature. His book, Last Child in the Woods, was a massive bestseller. While his subsequent books, like The Nature Principle, explored how it is essential for all of us to spend more time outdoors and in nature. His latest book further delves into this topic, Our Wild Calling, how connecting with animals can transform our lives and save theirs. Richard Louv will join us live ahead of an appearance he's making this evening at the Tattered Cover in Denver. At 9 o'clock, we'll have media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news on public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Dozens of people gathered outside Denver's City and County Building on Friday in support of DACA recipients. DACA refers to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that protects certain young immigrants from deportation. The program was begun in 2012 and allows people who were brought to the U.S. as children to be granted temporary protection from deportation. President Trump has ended DACA, and tomorrow the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on whether the program is valid. U.S. Representatives Jason Crow of Aurora and Diana DeGette of Denver joined Mayor Michael Hancock and State Representative Leslie Harrod of Denver at Friday's rally. The Colorado Independent reports that DeGette lambasted members of the Senate, saying their failure to pass the DREAM Act of 2019 cannot be tolerated. The measure has already passed in the House. Gladys Ibarra, a DACA recipient and a campaign manager of the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, told the gathering that she was scared, not only for herself, but for her two sisters, who are also protected under the program. The Trump administration has argued that ending DACA is within the president's powers and is not reviewable by the courts. A decision by the court may not come for months. Tomorrow evening, Padres y Jóvenes Unidos and the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition will hold a rally and vigil in support of DACA. Impacted individuals, their families, and local leaders will address the rally, which will happen at Longmont's Roosevelt Park Pavilion at 5 p.m. Tuesday. On Friday, the Adams County Coroner's Office released an autopsy report about the death of a 23-year-old Aurora resident, Elijah McClain. A pathologist was unable to determine exactly what killed the African-American. McClain was detained in late August by Aurora officers when he was on his way home from a convenience store. The police have said that he ignored commands and walked away from officers after they received reports that he was wearing a ski mask and flailing his arms. The officers used a maneuver to apply pressure on his neck, slowing the flow of blood to the brain. He was also injected with ketamine. In a 10-page report, the pathologist listed a variety of potential factors that could have contributed to McClain's death. The report did not rule out homicide committed by police. The Aurora Sentinel reports that McClain sustained more than a dozen abrasions and scratches in the struggle, but did not break any bones. McClain died about 6 days after the incident. Maury Newman, a lawyer for the family, has condemned how the Aurora police treated McClain, saying that he was minding his own business and was not suspected of any crime. The case has led to protests, one at the Aurora City Hall that shut down a council meeting. In Boulder, Councilmember Sam Weaver is hoping that his fellow members will choose him to become the next mayor. Bob Yates, who won re-election last Tuesday, is seeking to become mayor pro tem. Neither position gives more voting power, but the mayor is in charge of running council meetings, balancing members' speaking time, and advancing agendas. Weaver said in an email to the Daily Camera that following in the footsteps of Suzanne Jones will be no small feat, but he would like to try to carry on her legacy of efficient meetings, balanced community input, and addressing big policy tasks. Among others, Weaver's priorities include increasing affordable housing supply and implementing new middle-income housing assistance that was approved by voters. The mayor and the mayor pro tem are chosen by a vote of council members. The next city council meeting is scheduled for November 19th. Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold is calling for regulations or legislation requiring the U.S. Postal Service to notify election officials of any delay in delivering ballots. Griswold's call comes after more than 800 metro area ballots didn't get delivered until the afternoon of Election Day last week. Colorado Politics reports that 650 of those ballots were bound for voters in Aurora, where the mayor's race is still up in the air. Mike Kaufman, a former Republican Congress member, has a lead over Democrat Omar Montgomery by less than 300 votes. Griswold said that had it been known there were delivery problems, election officials could have asked a court to extend polling hours and taken other steps to give voters the chance to cast ballots. Of the 664 ballots that were delivered late in Aurora, only 141 were actually cast. That rate was about half of the citywide turnout rate in the city. Griswold said that there needs to be communication by the post office when their personnel discover a problem, whether it was of their making or not. A spokesperson for the post office said that there was no delay in the mail and that they met their standards according to the postage placed on the ballots. The St. Vrain Valley School District is on a 2.5-hour delay this morning. The forecast is saying that the snow will slow around 9 a.m. this morning, with skies gradually becoming sunny and the high around 28, and an overnight low of 20. Tomorrow mostly clear and much warmer with highs in the mid-50s. Right now it's snowing lightly and about 14 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, today is Veterans Day. It's a day to honour those who have served in different branches of the military. It's also a day to face some alarming statistics. Earlier this year, the Department of Veterans Affairs released a report saying that at least 60,000 veterans died by suicide between 2008 and 2017. It's estimated that 22 veterans a day take their own life. Well, the trailer for a documentary that tells the story of one of those veterans who died by suicide will be screened in Denver this evening. Ethan's Reach, the PTSD battle, a mother's mission in honour of her son. And that mother is Leslie McGivern. I spoke to her this morning and I asked her to tell us about her son.
Ethan was such a sensitive, kind little boy that he saw things at a deeper level at a very early age. I mean, he was only 7 or 8 when the Twin Towers went down, and he was devastated. I mean, that was the kind of kid he was. He felt things so deeply. And I think also then that carried forward into his experience with the Army and being deployed to Afghanistan and going through what he did. Again, he felt things so deeply and saw things that he couldn't unsee. And then when he separated and wasn't with his brotherhood anymore, he started to start having survivor's guilt for his squad leader that had died over there. And, I didn't understand the 22 veterans a day statistic at that point. I didn't even know about it until I lost my son. So I just thought, okay, he's just, having a little bit of a struggle with coming back into civilian life. We'll get you on the GI Bill. We'll get you, settled into, getting your own place, and it's all going to be good. And he had never been suicidal before at all. So I grossly underestimated it. And when this happened, it shocked me. It shocked all his friends. And when I was in my darkest moments and my fog where, I couldn't really barely do anything, I remember when I would go for walks, I would just think in my head that Ethan's going to help people. Ethan's going to make a difference, because I should have known, being a support person for him that he was coming back to. Been made aware either, you know, through literature or even, you know, support groups that, hey, these are the signs to watch out for. This is, you know, what they could experience. It's normal. Like, don't think they're just, you know, raging for no reason. This is PTSD. And then on the other side, I feel like Ethan thought he was going crazy. And at one point, I was looking back through my old text messages. Within a week of him taking his life, one of his text messages was to me that, Mom, I think I'm going crazy. I'm yelling at people that aren't there. And so I don't think he understood that he was experiencing something, unfortunately, that's become normal with PTSD and out there. But so he felt all alone. And I don't feel like he thought he could reach out to his brotherhood, as amazingly close as they are, because it would be a sign of weakness or they wouldn't understand. And in reality, they have all rallied around me, and I have formed wonderful relationships now with his brothers. And they are, some of them are experiencing almost the exact same behaviors, emotional issues, you know, thoughts that Ethan had. But now they're realizing, I'm not alone. Like, this is something that is real, and you're not crazy, and we need to address it. And so we need to understand, first of all, the veteran needs to get help, but the easiest way sometimes for somebody to get help when they're suffering is for those around them to recognize it and help them to get the support and help that they need. So that's a lot of what the film is about. The filmmakers came to me at the beginning of this year and wanted to do Ethan's story. And I was over the moon. I mean, I just thought, I'm now strong enough. This is my mission. I retired from my job as a mortgage banker, that I just thought, that's no longer important. This is the most important thing that I will do the rest of my life, is helping veterans and making a difference. And since then, his friends have gotten so close. I've hosted retreats for them and reunions so that they have each other. And they've all made a pledge that they will not have to go to each other's memorial services. And, you know, I feel like I'm just one person, and I'm getting there. But if I could rally and let other people know that this is something you could get behind, this is something we should get behind, these guys did so much for us, they made such a sacrifice, it's time we fought for them. And that's what my mission is with these filmmakers. And I'm so incredibly touched that they've chosen Ethan to be the face in their film. And and today is the 4-year anniversary of the day he took his life. And it's usually a day that I don't even want to wake up to. And today I find myself energized that this is going to be a way that we can put all of this emotion and sadness now into something positive and something that will make a change in Ethan's honor.
Well, I know that today is an incredibly difficult day, Leslie, and I'm very appreciative of you taking time to talk to us today. It is only 4 years to the day that you lost your son, Ethan. But you said that your mission now is to make sure that there's awareness out there. And so what awareness? You said you had no awareness about this. You didn't know about that statistic, 22 veterans taking their lives every day. There seems to be so much undiagnosed PTSD. And at the same time, we hear the military saying that this epidemic of suicides is on their radar. What support is there out there for folks? Because you said that you've spoken to friends of Ethan's, other folks who've served with them, and they're dealing with the same thing. So what support is there out there if people are looking for help?
There's a variety of things. And I think the very first step is for them not to feel alone. And for their loved ones around them to have more understanding, because I think from the very beginning, what makes people spiral even further is if that veteran feels like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what's happening. I'm unraveling. I'm losing it. and everybody hates me around me because I'm being a jerk and I'm putting a fist through a wall over something like I can't find keys, or, you know, I'm having inappropriate reactions to frustrations and anger. So I think once the stigma is, once it comes out into the open that, hey, this is real and don't feel alone, then that's the very first step to getting help, is people just recognizing that this is something that you can work through. Now, what works for one may not work for the other, but one thing for sure that helps a lot of these guys is a camaraderie, that they have each other. What I've been told from Ethan's friends is this mere fact that I have made a pledge to them to do retreats, which I've been doing from the very beginning for them, 1 to 2 times a year. I bring them all into Colorado for either a summer retreat or a winter, and keep them together, because there is a constant theme of, well, nobody understands. You don't get it. Like, you weren't there. You don't know what we went through. And so I think that really helps them, is having their brotherhood there and realizing they can be, you know, vulnerable with their brothers. That's huge. I've noticed they bring each other up. They cry on each other's shoulders. They can talk about things they can't talk with their wives, with their parents, with anybody else, but they can with their brotherhood. So to me, I will continue this whole retreat, tradition that I started. And also, I want to take it further and further, because I think other groups, just like Ethan's, could benefit from this, because there is an understanding. Also, because some of them are ahead in like where they went through this maybe 6 months ago, when somebody else is breaking down, they can say, okay, the VA now has a crisis center, which they do. They didn't have this when Ethan died 4 years ago. That you can walk right into the VA now and get seen immediately if you're in crisis. Ethan had an appointment that was 2 months out, and so he died 2 weeks before he ever made it to that appointment. But that, you know, so the VA did make a stride in that, and definitely some of the guys in Ethan's circles have used that. Some of them, not that drugs are the answer, but some of them have gotten on, anti-anxiety or antidepressant drugs or whatever, just to stabilize their moods better, to be able to deal with some of the anger comes up. I'd say also exercise, anything physical and getting outside. And that's why, like, the retreats that I've done, I always try to get them outside doing something and being with nature and exerting energy. And we went skiing all last April. That'll be featured in the film. And so you'll see some of that in the trailer. But, you know, everybody knows that is one of the best things, is exercise and, you know, kind of getting outside too, when you're too stuck with inside yourself. There's also pet therapy with having, you know, animals or horses or, you know, dogs. So there's a variety, but first of all, we've got to get that person, and we've got to all recognize that they need help and let them know we're all standing behind you. We're all here for you. We're going to find the right way, and we're going to be right next to you. You don't have to say, hey, I'm out of here. And unfortunately, that's too easy for them to say, unfortunately, because when you go into the Army and you go through basic training, they break you down, that death is not revered. It's not something to be afraid of. It's okay to take somebody's life. It's okay for you to die. So when you have been brainwashed, kill, 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 unfortunately, then it probably shouldn't surprise anybody that sometimes they take themselves out, because there's not that feeling that my life is so precious and worth so much, because they've had to take that away from these guys in order to put them out there.
Leslie McGivern. She is the mother of Ethan, who 4 years ago today took his own life. He's one of the estimated 22 veterans a day that die by suicide. And her story about her mission to honour her son, Ethan, and to raise awareness about the danger of PTSD and what so many veterans are going through. A trailer of that documentary is going to be screened in Denver this evening. It is at the IDC building. That's at 590 Cuivas Street. That's Q-U-I-V-A-S in Denver. It's from 7 to 9:30 p.m. It is a fundraiser to get the rest of the documentary made, which they're hoping to release on Memorial Day in 2020. There'll be veterans also speaking about PTSD and suicide at that event. And you can find out more if you go to Eventbrite, do a search for Ethan's Reach, the PTSD battle, a mother's mission in honour of her son. It is 8:24. You're listening to KGNU. Well, you may have noticed the proliferation of Christmas decorations in local stores. Even though Thanksgiving is still more than 2 weeks away, it does seem that the holiday season is upon us. And while it's often dubbed as the festive season, it can also be a very difficult time for those dealing with any kind of loss, says Kim Mooney, who is an end-of-life educator who's also worked in bereavement support for so many years.
So in one way, we're just totally overwhelmed with the commercial end of all this. And on the other way, it's kind of hard to find your way when you are overwhelmed. It may be, like you said, because of a death. For some people, they just moved. For some people, they have someone deployed. They may be dealing with depression on their own. But any kind of a change at all can be really hard in the time where the music starts and we assume that we're supposed to be happier, willing to spend more money, wanting to travel, liking big groups. You know, there's a lot of expectations that are built into this that we have to figure out how to navigate. And the good news is we can. We just have to know what kind of choices we have. And unfortunately, it's like many other areas where there's loss. It's the people who are dealing with it, who are depleted, who have to sort of protect themselves and defend themselves.
So give us a sense of what you hear from people as somebody who has been involved with support groups, primarily through hospice. So you've been dealing with people who themselves are battling, terminal mm-hmm. disease, who are dying, but also family members and those who are bereaved after they've lost somebody. Give mm-hmm. us a sense of really some of the challenges that people in those groups face that we might not be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, particularly around loss. And I think it's harder when you're not involved with hospice because you don't have a group of people around you who are saying this is something to anticipate. Let's take care of you. But what's true in general is, first of all, families don't grieve alike. And they're usually not necessarily the best support system you're going to have. So here's a time of the year when people come together and there's an expectation that you're going to support each other. But if you've had a death in the family, you've got six people who had a very different relationship to that. And the pressure to perform as a family, or the pressure to show up and be happy, can be really hard. So for example, this was really touching to me. There was a family that lost a young boy. He was about 9 years old. And his mother wanted nothing to do with the holidays. She didn't want to celebrate. She didn't want to have it acknowledged. The father wanted to do something, but he wasn't sure what. And the little girl wanted to have holidays. So what they did was they allowed her to take all of the lights and decorate her bedroom. So they compromised. And yet when you walked down the hall, they said, and she opened her door. It was like, you know, magic. So she got what she wanted, the dad got to help her, and the mother could, you know, pretend like it wasn't happening. So I think that the thing that happens is families have to talk about it ahead of time. You know, there are five things that are really important, and I think one is to make plans so that you're not just all of a sudden caught unawares, but to be really flexible with them. And part of that is having people around you that you can actually say, you know, Maeve, I want to come to the party, but if I have to leave after 15 minutes, would you please cover me or support me or whatever? Because to get that permission to be flexible, because we know people who are grieving in any way or exhausted, they may not know how they're going to feel in an hour. They may be fine being in a room with people, but when it comes time to share presents, you know, it might be hard. I think it's important, like I said, to enlist those people as allies. So people who are on medication, they should see their doctor. They may, you know, they need to see the people who have already been supported. I think it's important to be open to change because you may not want to participate in a way that you have, and yet you try it, or you try it with a little modification, and it turns out to be okay. And I'm not pushing anybody to pretend to be happy, but it never hurts to really look for what you can be grateful for. So we had a family that I dealt with, not a hospice family, but a family that was fairly isolated, and they were all coming together, and they were nervous. So what we did was we had them co-create a gratitude list. So six people sat down, and between all of them, they came up with two or three things that they were really grateful for, and many of them they shared. So they did something that was positive that made the day okay.
I think if you are dealing with bereavement and your social circle or your family knows that you've lost somebody, that's maybe a more obvious reason that people would be understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many other forms of loss. It could be the loss of a relationship. It could be, my goodness, we've done programming on, you know, bereavement due to a loss of a pet, which many people feel as profoundly as they would, you know, the death of a human.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people feel that that's not reason enough to grieve in the same way. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. We call it competitive grieving. And it can go either way. My loss is much worse than yours, or how can I possibly feel bad because you had three different things go on? And really encourage people in general, again, sometimes they have to defend themselves, but to recognize that whatever happens for you is as significant as, it's significant for you. So, you know, it'll show up like your mother wasn't that close to you, but your aunt was the one who raised you. Well, we see these hierarchies. So I have a lot of handouts for the holidays because, you know, if you put something on paper and give it to someone, it's more official. But I think that that's important, is to be able to say, this is hard for me. And honestly, the people who can't support you, this always seems so horrible to say, is don't be around them. You know, really, if they're not helping, this is a particularly vulnerable time of the year to have to deal with something that's straining. And as you said, it's not the day, it's the whole season. It's already started. The pressure has started. And not even in a bad way, the feeling of heightened, expectation, I feel it. You know, it's starting, you're right, the weather's changing, you know, soon things will be coming, and there are things that are going to be hard this year, but I know enough about it to protect myself during those things and to look for alternatives. We're not going to be celebrating the holidays the way we did, and so we're going to go visit friends, you know, or don't make the big dinner. Go to somebody else's house. Or people who are dealing with really, you know, close death loss, they don't have to send out Christmas cards. There's all these things we have ideas about and expectations. And frankly, you don't have to do any of them.
You can find out more about Kim Mooney's work and some of the workshops that she hosts on these particular issues, including one coming up locally on November 17th about creating rituals that work for us in the holiday season. It's all online at practically-dying.com. And do tune in this Thursday morning from 8:30 to 9:30. AM, as Kim Mooney will be my co-host in our quarterly end of life series. It is 8:31. We'll join headlines from the BBC.